but there is nevertheless under the words a little doubt about it. So he ought obviously to say the men, make clear the men slumped to the ground, or the soldiers, and that's different, you see, because if it's the soldiers, we know exactly what's happening, and we won't know, if he says the men, we won't know until we see that it's a military killing at the end. So it depends what he wants. If he wants to keep it ill-defined until the end, which is a very nice thing to do, so that the defining comes bit by bit, probably he could say the men or the whatever. Even then we wouldn't ever know how many were there, would we? Mm-hmm. Could we, in seeing this, which is what Jason wants us to do, who could say, were there many men, few men, from this statement? The men slumped to the ground. What could you see? Could you see a group? Could you see a few? Could you know? So we learn later on that this is an execution, and the title tells us that there won't be many men. You couldn't line up 250 men and go bang bang, you know. So it's not very many men. So there's no point in not telling us how many. As we say, the crash of the rifles rang out, the 15 men, which makes a great difference, don't you think, to the story? The 15 men felt slumped to the ground. The following silence seemed loud.
I've heard that before. Am I the only one who's heard silence called loud before?
No, I think probably it's a gen. I think it's true. I think that's what happens. But perhaps we ought to think of a way of making it new. That's Ezra Pound's dictum. Make it new. Make it new. There is nothing new. I have to tell you now. There is nothing new. It's our job to make it new. So anybody, any ideas about how to make the following silence seem loud? Or even to make the silence emerge from the sentence? Would following be the best adjective? It is totally exact.
Something like the silence echoed.
When we're doing something as direct and evocative as this, I think we have to look at every tiny detail. I don't know what to do with the following silence seemed loud. In a piece like this, that is correct outside the piece, but in the piece, the following silence was loud. It didn't seem loud at all. It was. So we have to do something along those lines. Sure. And the same thing, from his position, he could see them checking the bodies for life. With some, there was another shot. Would you really put all that in one sentence? From his position, he could see them checking the bodies for life. Okay? Now, this is a terrifying thing that comes next. With some, there was another shot, and it deserves its own sentence. Don't you think?
Change with the four as well right there.
You might say sometimes there was another shot. You might say we would all do different things, but we would all give the whole weight to the fact that this observer, wherever he is, and in fact we don't know where he is, at this stage we might think he was hidden somewhere. We know later on that he isn't. And that makes it more terrible than ever. Now, he noticed the faceless soldiers were impeccably dressed in their military outfits.
I think a problem with he noticed, even when I'm grading my student stuff, it's such a trivial thing or such a big thing that it's not just noticing.
Noticed is entirely the wrong word. It's a tiny little verb. In fact, I would say, and make it a fact, because it is a fact, the faceless soldiers were impeccably dressed. That makes them much more ominous.
I could be wrong, but I felt like he didn't even need faceless, that with everything he was describing, they already, it was showing that they were faceless.
In the description, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's, we use it later on in the piece as well, don't we? It is repeated. So one of them would have to go anyway.
Well, they're faceless until you give them faces anyway.
Hmm?
Because they're already faceless until you give them a face. So
yes.
Yes.
Now, do we want impeccably? Because he tells us that not a piece was not perfectly ironed, nor a boot that did not gleam. So he said impeccably twice, really, but the second use of the description is much better than the first.
Just thinking military outfits is really general, maybe unnecessary. You could say the soldiers were impeccably dressed, not a piece that was wasn't perfectly.
You could leave out impeccably, or you could use uniforms, which suggests that they were soldiers, because I think this is the first time, this is the first sentence in which we learn that they are soldiers. So we are getting that information into us. The soldiers were dressed in their uniforms, not a piece that was not perfectly ironed, not a boot that did not gleam. So because it's so direct and so clear, adjectives and adverbs kind of stick up and must be perfect. And then even their weapons sparkled from obvious care. He hasn't been in the military, for their weapons would be the first thing that would sparkle. Not even, but flatly, their weapons sparkled from obvious care. And that's much more important, a sentence.
What if instead of uniforms or military outfits, he gave us something more specific, like fatigues or dress blues?
Yes, whatever the terrifying word is, in their green fatigues or brown fatigues or whatever sort of thing, they begin to people the place. Yes, excellent idea. That do you remember the poem on this very theme that I read earlier about the soldiers lined up? There wasn't a single adjective in the whole poem, and that is unforgettable.
Actually, that was kind of what made me think of this when you read that. I kind of got this idea, but it made me think of what goes through a man's mind,
sure,
right after that happens, and so that was kind of the guiding thing.
I agree with that. I can see what you're on about, and you make it very clear at the end that the narrator is in a particularly uncomfortable position. The man had seen many executions. The prisoners never cried out. They were dignified and defiant, with their chins up. Stop me if anything occurs to you.
I think just that's another place where you don't need the dignified and defiant. I mean, if you're saying that that they don't cry out, or, you know, that they hold their chins up. I think that you can do enough with that. You don't have to...
I don't much dislike their chins up, but I do like the fact that when he's using adjectives in this entire sentence, the adjectives are the material of the poem. They are the information of the poem, of the sentence. They are the information, and I love to see that. They were dignified and defined. It gives to each of those words astonishing weight. The dignified and defiant men did not crowd. Ooh-wee. You know, but they were dignified and defiant. That's the stuff. So I probably would take with out if we're going to keep chins up, because it lifts the sentence. They were dignified and defiant, which are both abstract terms in many ways. Let's make it concrete. Their chins up. They were dignified and defiant. Their chins up. And so we have them moving, giving them purpose. He wondered how they could be that way till the very end. Perhaps it was just to retain the only thing left to them that was uniquely theirs. If it's the only thing, do we want uniquely? Because that's the same thing, isn't it? That was the only thing left to them. It is much stronger. Every time you take something out, the whole thing gets harder and harder. Freedom of choice. At least they could still... I love the irony in that. It's a very, very little freedom of choice. They hardly have any freedom of choice at all. But of course they do. So even holding their chins up is a symptom of freedom of choice. So at least they could still choose to be defiant no matter what was done to them. You can never take away freedom to choose how we react, those faces said. And maybe they were right.
Belaboring at all. I mean, if we watch a single soldier do this, then we have to figure out for ourselves why he's acting that way. We don't need it to be explained, and in fact, it's already inside us.
Very, very good. Never explain, never summarize. Put down what happens. If the faces say it, that's okay. And maybe they were right, ought not to be there. At least they could still choose to be defiant, what no matter what was done to them. And then you can even, who was it said that we needn't use the last two sentences? I love this destructiveness. The man didn't move a muscle, he didn't even blink. The man didn't move a muscle. He couldn't blink. Could he? If he didn't move a muscle. Figuratively, he didn't move a muscle. Well, why didn't we just say the man didn't move a muscle?
How
that semicolon is all right.
How about the man didn't even blink?
Well, I think now we are being introduced to the narrator here. Or to the witness, the man didn't move a muscle. I think if it had been the men, it would have been somewhere in the second paragraph. And we are quite right to say it's a single man, because his respiration was quick and shallow. So in the context, that's all right. The soldiers were nearer to him now, still checking everybody as they went. A shot here, a shot there. Even if there were some who survived the first round, they were sure not to survive the second. But we do know there are some who survived the first round, because we've heard shots. So it's going to be those who survive the first round who are sure not to survive the second, isn't it?
What does that sentence add, though?
Hmm?
What does that sentence add, though, that you don't already know?
Well...
Emphasis.
I think it's kind of...
to build tension.
If you might just say...
He's beginning to realize that he's one of those, although we don't know yet. He's starting to scare. That's kind of my... depends on that sentence. Kind of what she said about feeling a little bit of suspense there.
Yeah, what does anyone think?
I agree with the pause and the... what the sentence, the things that the sentence is doing is
which one, Matt?
Down.
Read it as you. A shot here, a shot there?
No. If they were, they survived the first round, they should have been survived the second round.
Yes. I think it is, I think that to use even pretty nearly always weakens the situation. Pretty nearly always. We must use it with the greatest care. And we know what's happening here. There's no doubt about it. We know that even if there were some who survived the first round, they were sure not to survive the second. I think that what this situation demands is those who survived the first round did not survive the second. It's the certainty of the situation, even if it gives us doubt and weakness. Those, or the men, or whatever you like, victims, whatever you want to say. But there's no doubt that you want a comma after the first round. The pause is right. Though he did not fear death, he feared how he would die. Though he did not fear death itself, he feared how he would die. These are minute things. How many people like, though he did not fear death itself, he feared how he would die? How many, in preference to, though he did not fear death, he feared how he would die? Any difference?
The rhythm's much better than the second.
For me, putting in itself makes it somehow aggrandize a kind of eloquence which the situation doesn't support. And death itself is not what you think, because actually there's only death left, though he feared death. He feared how he would die. He was glad not, he was not tied to one of the posts. That's a very, very good sentence, oddly enough, to finish the paragraph. Very flat, he was glad. Very simple. Very good summary.
Can I go back to a little bit earlier on talking about everybody? Your eye reads that everybody, and it breaks. I mean, it breaks the feeling in there.
Good.
I like each better. It also increases that inevitability towards.
I'm glad you brought that sentence up, because I don't want to keep on talking, and I want you guys to do it. There are other things about that sentence. The soldiers were near to him now, still checking everybody. But it hasn't been very long, so what does the word still imply?
Length of time.
That it's been going on for
a long time. Yeah, and they'd had several shots at it to make certain. But we know that they never passed the second round. So the verb is much better if the soldiers were nearer to him now, checking everybody as they went, which makes the thing different, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly puts him in the line, or at least suddenly puts him in the line.
Yeah. you can't do this unless the peace is strong. You know, when I was living in Sussex, the very old walls in the villages were made of round pebbles which had been carted up in the 16th century from the sea. They were about that size. Or they were dug out of the chalk hills behind. And great village craftsmen had made them into walls where the flints, as they were as close or as near apart as that. And they were line after line of these gorgeous flints, and then they were lined on top with the baked tiles baked in the village. Now those walls were protected. They were historically protected. And if you knocked one out with your little chisel and took it out, they were faced like that and they were backed like that, but in between was rubble. They were filled with rubble. If you took one out, the whole wall would undo like knitting, because the pressure is what kept them together. And they just, oh, your wall, your beautiful 16th century wall, would disintegrate in 3 weeks. And so you ran for the nearest old man in the village who knew how to put it right again. I like to think of writing being like that. That if you took one word out, if it was a bad piece of writing, the whole... But if it were a good piece of writing, it was stronger. So taking things out is very good. Yes. Those who survived the first round, they were great. Still checking, but the soldiers are nearer to him now, checking everybody as they went. Now, I wouldn't mind something before body. Why wouldn't I mind something before body? I wouldn't mind a really telling adjective before body. Because what I'm reading is everybody.
Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted to change it to each rather than everybody.
Yeah. I know it's words are mischievous. Now I wouldn't mind still, every still body. I wouldn't mind something like that. I wouldn't mind another word instead of body. So there are things which we have to do which are nothing to do with usage or anything else, but just what your year picks up. Okay, Willie.
In putting something between every and body, though, you have to make sure it limits it in the right way and not in the wrong
way. It would have to be a very, very fine insertion, and you would have to work like anything and get your books out and...
Because if it was every still body, then you think, well, are there some that are squirming or something, that they're passing by, or you know, things like that. I think you have to be careful.
I think, you see, what I would like to do is think around still body, because if they were moving, they'd shoot them. They know they were. So I would like to, but when he says body, they have to check. So they're not moving. So I probably myself would just to say every unmoving body is probably what I would personally do, as plainly as that. Mm-hmm.
That every immediately festering body. But I kept thinking as you're talking about the still body, it's every immediately festering body. I know it's bad, but...
You're not very serious, that's the trouble. yeah. Well, now, I think probably that would be as much as we could talk about at this kind of closeness. But a close reading, this kind of intensity, is not only necessary, but we learn so much about ourselves from doing it. You know, because I have to tell you that you'll make these same mistakes all through your lives. This is how you think. You make the same mistakes always. But if you know the kinds of mistakes you make, it's a lot easier to put them right. I know when I finish and I think, my stars, this might well be the best poem since Shakespeare. And I take it into to my wife and drop it negligently about. She will read it and say, well, this is good and that's good. And then she says, I see you using that old terrible rhythm, a terrible image about the heart again. And I say, it's totally new and fresh there, wasn't it? And then I go and change it. Because I know it's going to come in somewhere. I know the mistakes are going to be exactly the same. Most of them I've put right, but some sneak through. So go through like this always. Okay? Anybody want to say anything? We've read the story from that stage on, the last half of the story, the faceless soldiers.
Two more little picky things.
Anything that...
In the last line, suddenly does the same thing to me as he noticed. It's something that... that grates. You don't need it. The man felt two sweaty fingers on his...
Yes, because it wouldn't be suddenly. He's well aware that they're coming around doing this.
Yeah. Mm. And I would totally leave out the line, he was instantly terrified. Mm-hmm. I would just leave that out.
Good, I think I would.
I'm
very doubtful about BAM.
Yeah.
Anybody share a doubt about BAM?
Yeah.
We've got to have something there.
I wonder whether you'd hear it or whether... No. You see, it's the point is we're listening to him, the soldier. When the BAM comes, we've removed ourselves from him, so to speak. So I'm very doubtful about that.
I think you could even do something as insert feeling for a pulse and period. The click, you know, putting something as simple as the click of a gun or
the
some
hammer drew back.
The hammer drew back or
the last twist of the
knife. It seems he felt felt feeling for a pulse, but I imagine him, he's laying on the ground, he's probably not going to be able to see what's going on necessarily, but he could hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I almost want something inserted there that tells me that he hears. He can hear. So whether it's a click, he hears the click of the hammer.
Yeah.
But it has to be fatal. Whatever he hears has to be empty.
No.
And mm-hmm. I thought...
I think myself, and we all do it differently, that I probably would have him feel the gun at his skull, and I wouldn't put any more in. I wouldn't say the soldiers moved on or anything,
mm-hmm.
because he doesn't know. Something like that. Yeah. But we do like it. I think it's particularly, I think he's chosen a very difficult task, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think in most cases he's been very objective. And I think the little last paragraph isn't really ready yet. So that's what I think. I hope you all put things on your papers and let Jason have them. Is that any help to you, Jason?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very nice of you to let us go through your work like that.
I enjoyed reading it. Well, enjoyed.
Everybody got a copy of Seamus Heaney's Punishment? Was it part lefty? Oh, sorry. Those who sit behind the teacher get missed out. Have we got another piece of film? Something to write with?
I have something.
Will it work on this board?
It will. you want a round one or a round
one? I don't care what color it is.
Do you want it with a wedge end or a long end?
Oh, let's be thinking.
Which goes on my shirt?
Round, there you go.
Take something off, do we?
Yes.
Keep this up, you'll get an A. I want to talk about this little poem first, and we may continue it, because I'd like to do something the same with this poem that we've already done. And this is from Mahaney's collection called North. And it's called North because of various reasons. It echoes the fact that Heaney lived in Northern Ireland, and that when he wrote the poems in this collection, I think he was 33 or 34, so he's a young man, although very well known already. And he removed himself from Northern Ireland because he was at the heart of what we euphemistically call the Troubles. And they're so mysterious and ancient, a ritual, that it's very hard to say why or why they exist, and indeed why they stop as well. So This will reflect a lot of Heaney's worries about the civil war in which he was not engaged, but in which he was present and saw terrible things. And they are his meditations. At the same time, he was very interested in the preserved bodies which were being dug up from the turf, the preserving turf in Scandinavia, one or two in Germany, and some in Ireland, because these are all countries with very large peat bogs, and you can dig up oak trunks and even, in fact, pounds of butter, which might have been there for centuries, and they're perfectly preserved. And he saw in a book about this manifestation, about those preserved in Scandinavia mainly, because they were sacrificial bodies and meant to be preserved. They were nearly all men, but in Germany there were often women, and in Ireland always women. But most of the bodies we know about and can see are men. They were people who were chosen from the community, not criminals, and they were the spring sacrifices. So they'd have a year or perhaps something like 8 months chosen in the summer, when they would be fated and feasted and taken round in ribbons and that kind of thing. And then in the winter they would be sacrificed, usually by strangulation with a cord, and buried in the bog, and that would mean that the next harvest would be pretty good. So they were always youngish, and because it's natural, it's logical to think that if they sacrificed old guys, the harvest wouldn't be so good. This is a there's a whole book about these poems, or pretty well a whole book, but these are the early ones. And this is a famous one called The Grabball Man, G-R-A-U-B-A-L-L-E. And it's an introduction so that you'll understand when you come to this what the circumstances are that we're talking about. This is from a photograph in the book by a man called Bog, B-O-G, who's a Scandinavian, who wrote about it and which influenced Heaney so much. And the photograph is of this man, this body, which is on its side with its knees drawn up rather, and his skin, which is perfectly preserved, is black and shining, dyed by the peat, or it's a dark, dark brown, I guess, as if he had been poured in tar. He lies on a pillow of turf and seems to weep, a black river of himself. The grain of his wrists is like bog oak, the ball of his heel like a basalt egg. His instep has shrunk, cold as a swan's foot or a wet swamp root. His hips are the ridge and purse of a muscle, M-U-S-S-E-L. He's very much a poet who goes for exact images. And you see, as he's moving into the poem, the grain of his wrists is like bog oak, where the image is clearly relevant to the fact he comes out of the bog. And oak is preserved for 20 centuries, but it is dark. You can see the striations, and his wrist is as dark as that, and striated as clearly. But when we get into the thing, his instep has shrunk, cold as a swan's foot, or a wet swamp boot. His hips are, so the metaphors are coming in, the poem is strengthening. Up to now we've had only similes, but now we are moving so closely into our observation that things become other things. His hips are the ridge and purse of a muscle, his spine an eel arrested under a glisten of mud. The head lifts, the chin is a visor raised above the vent of his slashed throat that has tanned and toughened. The cured wound opens inward to a dark elderberry place. Who will say corpse to his vivid cast? Who will say body to his opaque repose? And his twisted hair, a mat unlikely as a fetus's. I first saw his twisted face in a photograph, a head and shoulder out of the peat, bruised like a forceps baby. But now he lies perfected in my memory, down to the red horn of his nails, hung in the scales with beauty and atrocity, with the dying gall too strictly compassed on his shield, with the actual weight of each hooded victim slashed and dumped. Now, there he remakes the thing for us, but what he comes to in punishment is the bog princess, which is a young girl they found in the bog, not a sacrifice, but obviously a person of some distinction buried for preservation in the bog. And he calls this poem Punishment for a reason, you see. You notice how simple all these things of observation are, clearly four-letter stanzas, so that they're confined to these simplicities. But what he's saying isn't simple, but the observation is intense and difficult. I can feel the tug of the halter at the nape of her neck, the wind on her naked front. It blows her nipples to amber beads. It shakes the frail rigging of her ribs. I can see her drowned body in the bog, the weighing stone, the floating rods and bowls. They wanted her to sink into the bog, you see. So she would be weighted with big stones tied to ropes and put along her body. The floating rods and bowls, under which at first she was a bark sapling that is dug up, oak bone, brain firkin. Do you know what a firkin is? It's a vessel, like a jug or something like that. So he sees the skull as a vessel to hold her brain. Her shaved head, like a stubble of black corn, her blindfold a soiled bandage, her noose a ring to store the memories of love. What's happening to this poem? I have to tell you that it's moved from the idea of a princess buried in the bog to those of a girl bound on the railings with a shaved head and tar pulled over her because she has, I can't remember the word, spoken with an English soldier, gone to a dance, maybe something like that. So they might have five or six of these girls. And this is what she is moving into, from the supposed sacrifice of the bog princess into her descendant, the Irish girl. All right, this is where it's doing. Moving from under which at first she was a bark sapling which is dug up, oak bone, brain firkin, her shaved head. That's the thing that I want you to know, how one moves from, he's a very man who works in images. It comes through, she was a bark sapling. So she was white and then unprotected and turned brown, and that is dug up, oak bone, brain firkin. And if it's a skull, it moves quite easily in the next stanza to her shaved head. Okay? You see how that works? That is the balancing point. And now we're looking at her shaved head like a stubble of black corn, and her blindfold a soiled bandage, her noose a ring, to store the memories of love, little adulteress, before they punished you. You were flaxen-haired, undernourished, and your tar-black face was beautiful. So he is an observer of the modern girl by now, knowing exactly what she looked like. I almost love you, but would have cast, I know, the stones of silence. I am the artful voyeur of your brain's exposed and darkened cones, your muscles webbing and all your numbers bones. I who have stood dumb when your betraying sisters called in tar, wept by the railings. Who would connive in civilized outrage, yet understand the exact and tribal intimate revenge? So it puts the two together at the very end. The two women are united. I almost love you, but would have cast, I know, the stones of silence. So he's recalling the ritual which would have destroyed sacrifices there in prehistoric days. And he's also the artful warrior of your brains exposed and darkened cones, your muscles webbing, and if these girls are in glass cases in museums, your numbered bones. I who stood dumb when your betraying sisters called in tar, wept by the railings. There we are with the whole nature of women who are betrayed and sacrificed from the old times down to these times. Who would connive in civilized outrage? So he's one of the community. He would have thrown the stones. Now he is standing there, is standing dumb when your betraying sisters called in tar, wept by the railings. would connive in civilized outrage, yet understand the exact and tribal intimate revenge. Civilized outrage is the kind of response we probably feel now, and he would agree with us if we think of these girls. That's the civilized outrage. On the same time, we are looking at a continuity from history through this kind of violence and the sacrifices that this kind of violence always performs. And so he understands, because his blood is that of the Irish communities, he understands the exact tribal intimate revenge. Now, do you see how this follows from image to image? We go through like that. A very simple, and the use of the adjectives in that